Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
What's it really like to be in the military? How's the military going to change in coming years? After all, we're pulling out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Let's be kind and say we're pulling out without a clear victory. Plus, there's finally public insistence on getting the government's budget under control, and the military's $500 billion a year budget so certainly cannot be immune from that. What will tomorrow's military look like? Will there be careers that will become more important in that new military? With me to address such questions is Nora Ben-Sahel. She is Deputy Director of Studies and a Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security. It's a Washington-based think tank that is focusing on shrinking the military budget. Indeed, she is the co-author of a new report, Hard Choices, Responsible Defense in an Age of Austerity. She's appeared on the BBC, CBS, Fox News, PBS, and now here on Work with Marty Nemko. Nora Ben-Sahel, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, in light of the major cuts in military spending, what are the implications for people with careers in the military or people who'd like to consider a career in the military?
Well, I think it's very clear that the military is going to be downsizing in the coming years, that there are going to be fewer people serving in uniform, particularly in the ground forces, because those have grown quite considerably in the past decade because of the demands of the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
And so as those demands decrease, there will be some amount of natural downsizing, but the budget constraints that you mentioned will also force that a little bit more. But it is important to know that that doesn't mean that it's going away as a career option. The United States is still going to have a vibrant military, and issues like recruiting and retention tend to be driven much more by the state of the U.S. economy than the total budget that's involved in the Department of Defense. So to the extent that the U.S. economy is worse, it's easier for the military to meet its recruiting goals, which means competition to get into the military is a little bit harder. But when the U.S. economy does better, the fewer recruits are coming in, and so there's more of an effort to recruit people to come in.
Yeah. I would imagine, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the decline in the number of ground forces seen are going to be a result of the fact that if we look at our recent wars, we are not at our best. That is, America doesn't, the battlefield of choice would not seem to be the ground. There's all this, you know, guerrilla insurgency and need to know the rural mountains of Afghanistan in order to prevail. Is part of the reduction in ground forces relative to the other forces simply a function of the fact that we need to put our efforts where our strengths are?
Well, some of it, I think, does reflect the fact that after Iraq and Afghanistan, it's hard to imagine that the United States is going to be involved in a major conflict of that size and scale again. It needs to be said, though, that U.S. officials, civilian and military, do have a terrible track record of predicting where ground forces are going to be needed in the future. Every war that the U.S. ends up fighting has not been expected or planned for by U.S. leaders. And so you do need to maintain strong capabilities in that area, even if you're not planning to do anything like Iraq or Afghanistan again. But I think the larger reason why the ground forces are likely to shrink is because of where U.S. strategy and where U.S. interests are heading, and that is inexorably towards Asia.
Mm-hmm.
There will still be U.S. vital interests at stake in the Middle East, but U.S. military, political, and economic interests are all increasingly going to be shifting to the Asia-Pacific. And from a military perspective, that is primarily a maritime theater. You need naval and air forces to deal with potential security challenges there, not as much ground forces.
You know, as an outside guy, I mean, frankly, what this part of the discussion feels almost 19th century. You know, at least outsiders, there's no 100% certitude, but statistically, one would say that if there were odds makers in Vegas, they would say that the next war, quote-unquote, is going to be fought in cyberspace, or it's going to be a bioweapon released in an international terminal in an American airport where there's no security, and it's going to transmit a communicable biovirus. It's not going to be a theater of operations, whether it be air, sea, or land. Is that a correct assumption on my part? And if so, is the American government still acting like it's the 19th century in terms of its planning for military support, how it's going to spend its military dollars?
Well, you sort of identified what the key challenge for all defense policymakers is, which is that it's impossible to know what the future is going to bring. And you obviously have to make some planning decisions, and you have to make some choices, despite the fact that you can never know exactly what's going to be required. And so what you try to do is you try to look at the most probable cases, but also have an insurance policy against those things which you think are less likely but still significant. And what that really comes down to is, where do you want to accept risk? Because there's going to be some risk, because you can't be prepared perfectly for every future contingency that's likely to arise. I do think that there is a tremendous amount of effort that is going into thinking about conflicts in cyberspace. There's a lot of defense money being put into that. But in some ways, the traditional geopolitics and international strategy still matters. It still matters where countries are located in the world. They still have interests in protecting communication routes, transportation routes, control over land and territory. So you need to be preparing for all of those things at once. The question is, as I said before, where do you accept some amount of risk? And I think that given the environment that the U.S. is going into, those Asian interests, even though some of it does sound very traditional and very, you know, security-focused, that still is a set of scenarios that defense planners are concerned about, especially given U.S. interests economically shifting towards Asia as well. But there has to be some amount of staying prepared for the unexpected, and that's why I think, you know, there's still going to be very viable career paths in the Army, even if we are talking about downsizing ground forces and not having the conflicts of Iraq and Afghanistan necessarily coming up in the immediate future.
I want to push back one more time, because it's so critical to in people making a personal choice about what career they're going to try to prepare for, that, you know, that they have an informed judgment about where the pockets of opportunity are likely to be. So I want to push back a bit. You've used the word risk many times. There's no, and to me, the missing part of the equation that we haven't discussed is cost. You know, yes, there is a risk that there's going to need to be communication lines open, and we need to have major battleships and ground forces and military bases like the enormous numbers we have in Europe. But the cost of those is so enormous, so that if one really assesses not only the risk of needing a ground force, but the cost thereof, wouldn't, especially in these unprecedentedly tight times where maybe the greatest threat to our national security is such a budget deficit that China could indeed bring us to the knees simply by calling in our debt, don't we need to place greater emphasis on the cost side of the equation and therefore put our money into the far lower cost, lower human resources required areas like cyber and like bioterrorism, and not major bases and battleships and airplanes and the like?
You're absolutely right that cost constrains all of the strategic options we're talking about. Ultimately, that is a choice that policymakers have to make, is what do you invest your money in terms of getting the military capabilities back, and what areas are you ready to say that, you know, you might not be as prepared for it if it happens, but that's what you have to do because you can't afford to have the most perfect capabilities for every possible scenario at the highest level of readiness at all times. We talk about this explicitly in the report that you mentioned, Hard Choices, and where we made those decisions about where we would recommend cutting costs over other places, we did prioritize investment in both naval and air forces, some advanced airplanes and warships, and trying to keep as much invested in those as possible for the simple reason that if you don't fund those, if you allow those production lines to close, it is very, very difficult to restart them again. And again, when we're talking about what the U.S. defense budget is going to be for the next decade, that sounds like a long time, and it is a long time. But in terms of things like procuring ships and airplanes, those can take decades. And so what you invest your money in this decade will really affect what capabilities the United States has for the next 20 to 40 years.
Yep. You know,
and so we recommended in our report, even though those things are very costly, the likelihood that you need them is significant enough that you want those capabilities to be there if you do need them. And that requires investing some now. We do, along the lines of what I was saying before about cutting ground forces, we do judge that it is less risky, still risky, but less risky to be cutting the end strength, the number of people who are serving in the ground forces, because you can regenerate that capacity faster if you need it. It's still going to be harder. You may not be as ready. You may take more casualties. These are not good things, certainly. But if you have to make choices, it is easier to regenerate ground forces for an unanticipated contingency than it is to have a new airplane that's ready to fly or a new ship that's able to transverse the world.
Dear listeners, I think this is important. This conversation is not abstract and about military policy. It's going to relate to your career choices, but I want you to be a little more informed as you listen to Nora and I kind of kick back and forth where priorities are likely to be. It will help you make a decision as to where you or someone you love is likely to want to put their time and investment. I do want to push back one more time. I am aware, as a career coach, I have so many clients who say, you know what, I'm really afraid to commit to this because then I'm going to cut off my other options. I'm hearing your core argument for why we need to start, keep building and planning for these new next generation planes and ships is that if we don't do it, it's going to close the door and we're not going to be able to do it because it takes decades for the government to do that kind of thing. Well, yeah, that would be closing another option. But given the probabilities and given the costs, does it really make sense to spend those incredibly numbers of billions of dollars on something that may be a fairly low probability need in an era when we have such budget problems and it is a Herculean but less costly task to go and try to stop the likely terrorist of the future, which is going to be solo operators sitting with a suitcase nuke or radiological device in downtown Manhattan? That's a higher probability event but would cost a lot less to defend against.
Oh, I think that's exactly right, and I don't mean to be implying that it's a choice between doing the kinds of things I'm talking about with the more traditional elements of military power and the types of new threats and challenges that we face. Even the types of budget cuts that we're talking about to the Department of Defense in a worst-case scenario, the largest numbers that are possible for cutting the defense budget is around $900 billion over the next 10 years. Now, that's a lot of money, clearly, no matter how you slice it. But as a percentage of the DoD budget, that is still going to enable you to prepare for the kinds of threats that you're talking about. Some of those things are not actually Department of Defense monies that need to be spent countering terrorism and so on. Some of it is DoD, but some of it is also Department of Homeland Security and other criminal investigative agencies. Where we really look at the report is, what capabilities in DoD do you need to be prepared for the widest spectrum of things in the future? And we didn't recommend cutting any money from cyber capabilities for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. Where we really made our trade-offs is in the traditional combat forces, because you do need to make those cuts somewhere. And that's where our argument comes from about cutting ground forces in order to be able to invest more in the air and naval forces. But I completely agree. All of these debates about what capabilities you should have all depend on what your assessment is about what future challenges the U.S. is likely to face. And it's not just whether the risks are low or high. You're very right that some scenario in Asia could be very, very low risk. But the question is, what are the consequences of it? If it's low risk but very high consequence, in general, that probably is something you should still be investing in, even if it is low risk.
Yep, there's no question. We have to look at the magnitude of the consequence. And alas, the consequences in our era of ever miniaturization of weapons, where indeed a vial of a biovirus released in an airport could have as greater devastation than a typical traditional bomb set off in China. It's the magnitude of all of these risks is enormous. I want to share with you, let me let our listeners know, first of all, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. We're talking about the new military. We're talking with Nora Ben-Sahel. What are going to be the career opportunities, especially in an era in which we are less likely to be engaged in what we call military adventurism, going into the Iraqs and Afghanistans of the world, and in an era of unprecedentedly tight budgets, when indeed maybe our greatest security threat of all is our enormous debt, including to China, which could indeed call our debt instantly, which would bring our financial house down quite quickly. What I'm telling my clients as a career coach, is that the pockets of opportunity, and some of these are not obvious, in addition to what I've talked about in the whole area of cyber terrorism and bioterrorism and solo actor terrorism, is, of course, the Middle East. The Middle East for thousands of years has kind of been the cradle of conflict, and it has been the insoluble problem of trying to maintain long-term peace. Is it correct that telling somebody to get, you know, familiar, to become fluent in Arabic, for example, or Farsi or Pashtun, is indeed, and understanding the culture as well, is critical in light of the fact that every time you open the New York Times or the Washington Post today, what, you know, it seems like half of the scary articles are related to things Islamic, radical Islamic. Do you agree with that?
I do, in that those are going to be career fields in the military as well as probably right. in broader society, but certainly in the military, that are going to remain in very, very high demand. Regional knowledge, particularly in the Middle East, but also in Asia as well, is going to be always in very, very high demand within the military. People who have real, not just linguistic skills for being able to do things in the intelligence world, but to understand the context in which developments are playing out, to be able to interpret and make sense of what what may seem like very threatening behavior on the one hand, but might not be, or vice versa, to be able to, you know, figure out how actions of certain countries really affect security is not always as straightforward as it seems. And so there will continue to be very high demand for people who really understand cultures and language skills around the world.
Right. So, Norris, let's say I'm your brother, and we've had this little conversation, and we agree ground forces are going to be down. And let's say I'm a guy who's looking for a career. We agree that the growth is going to be in Asia. We agree that the growth is going to be in the Middle East. We agree that understanding of language and culture is very critical. We understand that bioterrorism and cyber terrorism and solo actor terrorism are likely to be major threats. And I say, you know, I'm not an engineer. I'm not a computer programmer. So there's not an immediate path for me. I'm a typical social science kind of guy. What would you say I should do to prepare myself for a particularly rewarding career in the military?
Well, I'm sure you talk about this on your program all the time, right? But you have to follow what your passion is and what you're interested in. And if you are sort of leaning, if you have interest in the social sciences, in language, and in culture, pursuing those interests makes you very, very valuable to the military. You can also use the military as a way to develop those skills through officer programs, the Reserve Officer Training Corps, ROTC programs. Mm. You can go to school on the government's dime to get your university education, mm-hmm. and you can develop those language schools and stuff there in exchange for serving a four-year commitment after mm-hmm. college. Yeah. There are other programs like that where, you know, not only having those skills will help you with a career in the military, but the military can also help you acquire those skills in the first place,
right.
whether you decide to stay in after that initial four-year commitment for a ROTC cadet, for example. You know, those are going to be transferable skills to the civilian society because that kind of regional knowledge and expertise is quite valuable across a wide range of employers.
Right.
So you can do that to prepare for a career in the military, or you can use the military as a way to gain that expertise that then could further your career in the military or give you more options if you choose not to serve beyond that initial enlistment period.
Exactly. When I think of ROTC, however, I think of 17 and 18-year-olds, and the NPR listenership and the listenership to the show tends to be 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. Any advice for people who are not 18? Do they go to ROTC too? ROTC is, you know, what advice do you have for them?
Well, you know, you can actually enlist in the military up until your late 20s and early 30s, depending on the specialty. So maybe still on the lower end of the audience you just mentioned, but it's not just 18-year-olds. On the higher side, you know, if people.
By the way, 42. Excuse me, I interrupt you just for factual correction. You can enlist in the in the army up to age 42. By the way.
For certain specialties, you
right.
can, not
okay.
for... The age cutoff does vary depending on your particular specialty. The cutoff of 42, I think, tends to involve more of the intelligence, technical sides
mm-hmm.
of things.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. So, you know, there are viable careers there. I think for people who are, you know, at more advanced in their career, there are civilian jobs that do all of these things. Military officers and even enlisted personnel, they rotate jobs every 2 to 3 years, which is mm-hmm. wonderful in terms of their own professional development, right? I mean, if you have a 20-year career in the military, you're not doing the same thing for all 20 years. Every 2 or 3 years, you have a new assignment.
Right.
But it does mean that in a lot of staff, in military organizations, civilians provide the institutional knowledge. Mm. You know, because the military folks are coming in and out every 2 years, and the civilians are the ones who've been there 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, sometimes 10 and 20 years, who really provide the continuity. And so there are lots of opportunities for civilians, even mid-career civilians, to take those kinds of positions, civilian positions within the Department of Defense, working directly with and for the military, even if they're not in uniform.
So, right. So, good. So, let's say I'm 30 or I'm 40 or I'm 50, and I'm a civilian. I'm not going to be going, I'm not joining ROTC, but I you know, and I am, like our listenership is more intellectually oriented, more learning skills oriented. Right now, I'm your brother. What do you tell me to do very specifically, how to go from where I am, let's say underemployed schnook here in the Bay Area, to well-employed person in some one of these areas, you know, whether it be cyber or biological or Middle East or cultural or stuff? What do you tell me to do step by step to go from where I am now to where I could be?
There are lots of different ways to go about pursuing that. You know, there are there's a website called USA Jobs, which has all sorts of job listings for federal government agencies. That website has been problematic in terms of being up to date. You know, the government is not your Silicon Valley high-tech company, so the technologies lag a little bit behind. But, you know, you can go talk to military recruiters. Even if you're a civilian, they can give you a sense of what types of things they're looking for, and may be able to point you to some opportunities. Talking to folks who are in uniform, I know that that can be a little bit challenging because not everybody knows somebody who's in the military. But really, you know, sort of just looking at jobs listings and networking in defense contractors, there's a lot of, particularly on the technical side, but increasingly also on the cultural side, you know, the social science side, lots of people are being brought in through defense contractors.
Right.
And those contractors are located around the country.
Right.
You know, there's a high concentration in Washington, where I'm based, but they really are all around the country and even all around the world. And they, you know, deliberately put people in positions in the government, even if they're not civil servants applying directly for a federal job. They place people physically in government offices, including within the military, on a pretty regular basis.
Right. I want to stay right with that because that is my sense, too. I agree with that. Defense contractors where the action is, and there's going to be greater access. You know, trying to get into this, talk to people in the CIA isn't the easiest thing in the world. But talking to a contractor, if you, Nora, were trying to give me advice as to how I could get some face time with the right defense contractors, are there networking groups? Are there online groups? What would you suggest that Marty Nemko do?
I think the first step is to do a little bit of homework on the internet, right? That's always the first step when you're trying to figure out what you're doing. You know, do searches for positions that are available with the kinds of keywords that you know, that describe the kind of thing you want to do, and see which defense contractors are hiring in those areas, or even are just doing work in those areas. Contractors have to fill a lot of positions, and so they're going to make that kind of those kinds of listings pretty publicly available and pretty widely available. And then I'd say from there, you know, you go through the usual ways of networking that you do to get any job. You know, you try to do informational interviews, try to get to know more about companies and so on. See if you can tap your personal network, you know, to help get you a contact directly or through friends of friends there. And I think those traditional sources of looking for positions helps. In that sense, it's not different. If you're looking at the defense contractor world, it's not that different from getting any other civilian job.
What I tell my clients to do is to look at two sources. One is the Federal Register, which lists all of the requests for proposal that come out from the Defense Department to contractors. And the other is there, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but there's another publication that lists who got what grants, et cetera. And looking through there is going to find out who's the recent winners. And you contact some of the recent winners because they are the ones who may be hungry. Does that make sense?
I think that does make sense. You know, it's important in the context of the budget discussion we were having before that I do think defense contractors are going to get hit. They're going to be there's going to be less money available for defense contractors as a whole, and that is going to affect employment prospects. There's no question about that.
Yep.
However, there still are going to be areas that are in very high demand. There still are going to be those positions, even if though there may not be quite as many as there have been over the past decade. And so I think that that still is very much a viable career path, even though it is going to be more competitive than it has been in the past decade.
Yeah, I think your point is well taken. As I've been watching C-SPAN hearings, you hear Congress being really tough on the people that are testifying on the use of contractors, and they're trying to tighten up on it. They believe that, like, it started with the TSA, you know, when the TSA was contracting out airport security, and then they brought it in-house into government employees. I'm seeing them do it, you know, when they take in a situation like what happened with BlackRock contractors in Iraq, and they're now using that to probably, you know, just broaden the notion that indeed we want to hire fewer contractors and more in-house, you know, government employees. Is that a correct analysis in your judgment?
Well, I do think that's where a lot of folks in Congress and even in DOD would like to go. The reality is that becomes even harder during constrained periods of constrained resource periods when you're talking about having budget cuts. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to hire a contractor on a temporary basis that you don't have a long-term commitment to than it is to hire a civil servant. So even in this area of budget cuts, as I said, I do think it will be more competitive than in the past. There's no question about
mm-hmm.
that.
Good point.
But ironically, there may be the contractor community may be slightly more insulated from those cuts than the direct government civilians, the civil service positions, may be, because it's much more difficult to get rid of a civil servant once you've hired them. If you hire mm-hmm. a contractor, mm-hmm. you know, even if it's for a year contract, 2 year contract, 3 year contract, whatever, you're not making a decades-long commitment.
Good.
And it's a lot easier to renew those contracts than to try to get rid of a civil servant once you
Good. That's a, that seems like a nice, fair, balanced look at that. So, my dear listeners, if you're contemplating whether you want to be a government employee or a contractor, that presents both sides pretty darn well. It is my prediction, and of course, you know, they say he who lives by the crystal ball eats broken glass, but it's my belief that President Obama, notwithstanding the current situation, is going to win in 2012. As a guy who's in the media, I'm well aware of the power of the media to influence elections, and the media absolutely loves him, and he will win, in my judgment. But let's make the assumption that I'm right and that he wins. What do you think he's going to do regarding defense after he no longer has to worry about running for election? Because after all, my clients who are planning their career have got to look ahead, not just what's going to happen next year, but down the road. How do you predict things are going to change if Obama wins in 2012?
Well, I actually think that this issue of the defense budget and how to do more with less is going to be a key issue for the next president, whether it's a reelected President Obama or whoever the Republican nominee ultimately is. This is going to be the key defense issue facing the Defense Department and the president, regardless of who wins in 2012. I do think that if President Obama wins the election, there may be more room for the kind of grand bargain that's being talked about right now by the Supercommittee on Capitol Hill, which ties significant cuts in the defense budget along with a package to reform entitlement programs. I think that that's where the debate ultimately is going to have to go if politicians are serious about cutting the U.S. deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Whether, you know, I don't think there's going to be much progress in this area either with the Supercommittee, which has a deadline of reporting back by the end of this month,
right.
Or by Congress or the president next year, because 2012 is an election year,
right.
And you tend not to get grand political initiatives in
right.
an election year.
Right. Makes good sense. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Nora Bensahel. She is the Deputy Director of Studies and a Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security, Washington-based think tank. She's co-author of a new report called Hard Choices, Responsible Defense in an Age of Austerity. Let's go to the phones. If you have a question for Nora Bensahel, specifically related to careers in the military or anything else we've talked about in this interview, I invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, are there... is there anything, we've been talking about specific careers that might be, or areas of opportunity, but many of us, especially in the Bay Area, which is not exactly the most pro-military part of the United States, doesn't know a lot about what it's really like to have a life in the military. I know you're a civilian yourself, but is there anything you know about what life in general is like in the military or in some subset of the military that might surprise our listeners?
I think what I mentioned before, that that military officers and enlisted personnel rotate jobs every 2 to 3 years is probably pretty surprising to people who don't know everything about the much about the military.
It is to me,
Which is, it seems to be a very conservative organization, and there's a straight promotion path, and you know, and you sort of have to work within set rules. But because of this rotation policy, where people are, you know, sent to do new jobs every 2 to 3 years, people gain a great deal of expertise very quickly in new areas. There's a tremendous amount of diversity across a military career, no matter what particular area you come in to the military focusing on. There are certain career fields, and, you know, there's a sort of more formal process for figuring out who's in which area. But even within those, the types of different experiences in different parts of the world and in just different types of jobs, going back and forth between a human resources position to a substantive position to working on a regional staff of a military headquarters, I mean, those are all possible career options throughout a career, even for someone who's just a straight infantry person. I think that there's a lot more room to explore new areas and to have different experiences than I think people who don't know much about the military would assume, you know, where you're just out on military exercises and training and all of that. There certainly is a lot of that. There are also a lot of opportunities for education. The military takes training, its force, very, very seriously. And so it is possible if you're an officer to get people get sent to graduate school all the time. Master's degrees, very common. People are often sent to get PhDs and then can teach at one of the academies, or, you know, other sorts of professional training opportunities that really give people a very, very wide range of experiences, no matter what their particular military specialty is.
Interesting. By the way, I want to give out the phone number again. If you have a question for Nora Ben-Sahel about careers of the present and the future in the military or anything else that she and I have been talking about in this last half hour, I do invite you to call for the last time before this is your last opportunity. Phone number 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I'm curious about your career. I mean, you know, 89% of all the people in the military are men. You are not in the military, you're a civilian, but you are a woman. And how did you get interested and involved and so successful that you are now Deputy Director of Studies and Senior Fellow at the Center for New American Security? Tell me a little bit about your genesis.
I've always been interested in international relations, even going back to high school, which makes me somewhat unusual in that I knew what I wanted to do very, very early on. Getting to know the military is a little bit trickier, especially if, like me, you come from a family that has no military experience. But, you know, I ended up going to not just university, but I went to graduate school. I had an opportunity while I was in graduate school to take a brief leave of absence from my PhD program and go work for an Army contractor in Germany for about 2 months. And that really helped me develop the skills to understand what the military was doing, to be able to speak their language a little bit. But I've actually found that even though my career field is very male-dominated, I've had a lot of wonderful mentors, both to some more senior women in the field, but a lot of more senior men as well, who took a great interest in my career and answered my questions patiently and helped me out. It's, you know, the military is, again, seen by outsiders as very competitive and very, you know, straight-laced and all of that. But I've found an actually really wonderful community of folks who are really willing to have been willing to help me and mentor me. A couple of bad experiences along the way, but that's, you know, that's probably pretty much true for anybody in their career field. You know, you come across particular individuals, you know, who you don't work well with or who for whatever reason don't want to help you out. But in general, I've been very fortunate to have wonderful mentors along the way.
Most people don't know this, but because the media is always saying the men and women serving in the military, they don't realize that indeed, for example, 98% of all the combat deaths were to men, in part because only men are allowed to serve in direct combat. You predict that's going to change?
I do, and it's changing. This is one of those cases where the policy has not kept up with the reality of what's happening every day in military operations. Women are in combat every day, even though they are not allowed to serve in what are designated as direct combat specialties, particularly in the Army and the Marines. You know, you can't be a straight infantry officer in or enlisted personnel in certain areas if you're a woman. But the reality of today's combat is that there, you know, there used to be a front line. There used to be folks where people were up front and the people up front did the shooting and were more likely to be shot at. And, you know, those are the positions that were and still are reserved for men. But women have been allowed to serve in all of the various support and other types of positions. And those are the ones who are, you know, those positions are as much on the front lines today as an infantry soldier. You know, women serve, for example, in transport functions, driving trucks and stuff. That is the most dangerous job in Afghanistan today because the supply lines are so insecure.
You know, there
And women are taking those jobs and dying every day because of them. Well, I think that policy is going to eventually catch up to the reality of what's happening.
Well, it's still 98% of all the deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan have occurred to men, and this notion that because in the infantry and the front lines, the ones who are supposed to be shot are men, we're going to protect women, it feels in an era of supposed gender equality of opportunity that the opportunity for success and the opportunity to risk one's life should be fair. There should not be gender preferences in such an area, but I digress. Let's go to the phones.
There are increased moves in that area, though. You know, the U.S. policy changed last year, and women are now being allowed to serve in the submarine force, which is has been a huge change because of concerns of the tight living conditions there. So I think that there will ultimately be a change in this policy about women in the force because, you know, you want as strong a capability as you can, and women are talented just as much as men are. And I think that the desire to keep that talent in the force is what's ultimately going to drive this rather than any sort of ideological agenda.
Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with Nora Bensahel. What is your question or comment?
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, I'm the only caller. Okay. Hello. I tried to join and enlist a couple years back. Hello, you still there?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. I tried to enlist a couple years back, but I'm a super dyslexic person, and I'm wondering if there's any kind of accommodations for people like me when they're taking the entry test, because I have very hard time to read, and it's really slow for me to read, and it's time. So that's my question.
I must confess that I'm not an expert in that area. I don't know much about the testing process itself and how those tests are administered. So I'm afraid I can't help you particularly with that question.
Sorry, and I can't as well. What you might want to do is simply go to your recruiter and ask. In fact, you know, there are, we live in an area of exceptions. So if, you know, you find out whether indeed if you can get a letter from a licensed psychologist or whatever, whether they can be, you know, like there is, it's amazing that on the SAT, you can get extended time. You know, you get a letter from a psychologist and the rules can suddenly be bent for you. You can take all the time you want, or at least, you know, a lot, double extended time or whatever. So, you know, we live in the area of exceptions, and there's tremendous efforts to try to improve options for people with disabilities. So what I would do if it were me is I would go to either the military recruiter, or if you're concerned they might be biased, I would go to something, you know, an advocacy organization like the Center for Independent Living and ask them if they are aware of such things. Or Jewish Vocational Services. Don't get turned off by the word Jewish. It is open to everybody, as so many Jewish charities are. And ask them if they're aware of a way into the military, despite the issues you have and the disabilities. I hope that helps. We have time just for one more question, and we have no more calls, so let me just ask you one more question. I'm going to ask you to put your crystal ball hat on, and don't be the good PhD rigorous scholar that you are, but shoot from the hip for me for a moment. Allow yourself the luxury of that. Make believe you and I have had two beers together. We're sitting in a bar in D.C., and I say, make one more prediction about how the military is going to change in the coming decade that might have career implications. What would be your shoot-from-the-hip guess?
I really think we're going to see more flexible career paths in the military, and that will affect every specialty and every area. Right now, there's a system which is known as the upper-out system for promotion, that, you know, at certain levels of service, you either have to be promoted or you basically have to get out of the military, and a standard military career is seen as 20 years. That was a model that worked really well during the industrial age. It's not a good model for today's environment where you have where expertise and technical knowledge is needed, and people can physically serve longer because the physical demands of being in the military are far less today than they were in the 1930s and 1940s.
Yeah. Look, we just had another call come in, so let's take the advantage of the opportunity. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Nora Bensahel. What is on your mind?
Yeah, kind of an elephant in the room. It's always been that the least intelligent people go into the military, especially at the age of 18. These are people who did poorly in school, and maybe that doesn't matter for purposes of fighting when you want soldiers to carry a gun or fire a weapon. Maybe you don't need a high IQ. But the other thing is, I've always wondered why people... I've had friends who went into the military and they studied various things, electronics, that would lead to a career outside the military. Most of them didn't think of a 20-year career when they went in. But I've always been curious, what do you get out of it if you study something so focused like weapons training or how to fire a certain cannon? I mean, what are you going to do with that in private life? That's where all these veterans coming back have no real job skills and end up jerking lattes at Starbucks as a reward for the service to America.
Nora?
I'd respond in a couple of different ways. I fundamentally disagree that it's the least intelligent people in society who serve in the military. We do tend to see people from lower socioeconomic ranks serving in the military, but that's not correlated with intelligence. And in fact, it becomes, the military has been for many different communities an engine of social mobility, of enabling people to get the education that they might not have been able to get if they hadn't joined the military, and then generating good careers both in the military and when they return to civilian life. The kinds of skills that military personnel gain on the job, even if you're talking about something that is so focused as the examples that you mentioned of weapons training, and there are lots of careers that don't involve those kinds of things. But even in those areas, the broad management skills that come from being in the military are really quite remarkable. The management experience, even of a junior non-commissioned officer, the number of direct reports that person at a young age and at a, you know, relatively little experience has to manage and get team building and real capabilities out of dealing with a whole wide range of issues is enormous. Today, people who are at very junior ranks in Iraq and Afghanistan are responsible for huge amounts of money that gets spent in the local economy. Those types of skills are very, very transferable. Sometimes it's difficult to get people in the military to figure out how to communicate those skills in a way that is intelligible and attractive to civilian employers. And so there's been a lot of help that the military has provided in terms of career transitions and helping, you know, translate military skills into a language that civilian employers will value. But the skills are very much there, and even if the substantive expertise of being, you know, someone who's been a weapons trainer their whole life, they're really capable of doing a whole lot more than that specific substantive area.
I want to thank you for the call. And Nora, I want to thank you. Is there any last I want to ask, just leave you with a softball? Is there anything else you would like to leave our audience with that you think would inform their decisions about how they or someone they love can either get into the military and have a very rewarding experience, and or if they're in the military or have someone who they know who's in the military, have an even more rewarding experience there?
I just think just understanding the diversity of career options there is absolutely critical. You know, it's not just one size fits all. You don't all have to do exactly the same thing. There is some element of that, right? I mean, the military is a hierarchical institution. It can be somewhat conformist, and as I was mentioning with the federal government, you know, it's not always on the cutting edge the way that some private firms are. But lots and lots of people find really rewarding careers, you know, not just in terms of the skills they learn and the work that they do, but from serving their nation. And I think that if you talk to veterans or current military personnel and you ask them what they value most about their job, they will mention some of the specific skills. They will mention the particular friendships that they make with folks. But I think they will also mention the psychic value of serving your country, I think, appeals to a tremendous number of people.
Yeah, I have need to add one more 500-pound elephant in the room, which is we're always afraid of going into the military because we're afraid of getting our head blown off. But I think we are, because of the Iraq and Afghanistan and frankly the Vietnam experiences, we are going to be entering, and because of our budget problems, we are going to be likely entering a period of relative military isolationism. So the likelihood of our engaging in a, you know, an actual war where you can get your head blown off with shrapnel is going to decrease. So I think the risk-reward ratio of the entering the career from a simply safety standpoint will improve over the next decade or two. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it isolationist. I think the United States military is going to continue to be very actively involved all around the world. world, but in a peacetime status, mm-hmm. much more than in the kind of conflict that we've seen, which has, you know, has been very, very difficult for many people. Many families have lost sons and daughters and husbands and wives, and I certainly don't want to minimize that sacrifice. That obviously has to be taken into consideration with all of the things I've been saying. That does make this a very unique career path. But especially as U.S. forces withdraw from Afghanistan, which the president has said will be by 2014, the military is going to go back to being primarily peacetime military for some period of time. And so those particular personal dangers, although they will never go away, that is part of the deal of being in the military, it will become less risky to the extent that the U.S. is not actively involved in two wars overseas.
Indeed, as Churchill said, war is hell. But in fact, if we are going to be more of a peacetime army, the risk-reward ratio may indeed change. And one thing is that I wouldn't change is that I had Nora Ben-Sahel as my guest on Work with Marty Nemko. You did a good job, and I appreciate it very much.
Great. Thank you very much.
By the way, Nora, are you still there? Good. If there was one thing you'd want my listeners to read, if they want to understand more, do you want them to read Hard Choices? And if so, how do they get there? Or is there something else you'd like them to read?
Well, I'm always happy for people to read our reports. The document that I mentioned, Hard Choices, is available at the website of the Center for a New American Security, which is just CNAS.org. And it gets into some of those broader strategic questions about what do we want a military for before you can sort of drill down into the, okay, what does that mean in terms of the particular career paths and issues that will follow from that?
Yeah, we tend to not take seriously here in the Bay Area careers in the military, but it is an under the radar and yet we have a $500 billion a year budget. There's a lot of hiring that does go on even in tough times. So I do commend your reading that report and do thinking about military-related careers for yourself or someone you love. Nora, again, thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
You're welcome.
Okay. And now, as always, we only have about 13 minutes, but I want to spend as much of it as I can helping you. So if you have a problem, military or otherwise, related to your career, either because you don't have a career, you don't have a job, you are unhappy on your job, you are self-employed and want to run your idea by me and see if I would indeed fund it if I were your business if I was your venture capitalist, or you simply want some suggestions for improvement or getting yourself psychologically healthier so that you can move forward and do what you know you need to be doing in the work world. All of those are good reasons for what I call a 3-minute career makeover or a workover, in which I will not pummel you, I promise. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for that 3-minute career makeover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. It seems like we already have calls on the line, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air.
Hey, Marty.
Hi.
I'm a part of a group of women from about late 40s to mid 60s. Most of us are writers, but we were all thinking that it would be nice to have sort of secondary income in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Can you make suggestions for someone who's, you know, in that age range who might want to make just a bit of extra income to do
sure.
weekends meet?
Writer, the most common route are the following. You tell me which of any of these say have any appeal. They are editors. You know, it's amazing how many people with bachelor's and master's degrees can't write worth squat. And so whether they be business executives or nonprofits writing a fundraising pitch letter, they need somebody to edit their work, or websites. How many websites have really crappy writing on it? You know, so going to a website that is clearly has got some traffic, and taking an article that you think would be terribly written, that you think is terribly written, and rewrite it or edit it can be a great way to show, not tell, your ability, and that can get you some money. The next item, which of course is extremely common, is a tutor. In high school students, college students, so many of them are terrible writers because we now do admit nearly anyone to college. Some of them really don't have very poor thinking skills and therefore poor writing skills, and desperately need, in order to get by, they need somebody to help them with their term papers, their theses, etc. You know, that's a great way for writers to make money. And third, there's so much of our purchasing is on the web, and every one of those web items needs some copy written to describe that cosmetic or those shoes or the computer technology item, that software. So very often they hire writers on that. You know, they're not going to make a great living, but you're talking, I was glad you said, make a little extra money on the side. Those are some of the ways that one can make a little extra money on the side. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. Those are good ideas, and we'll start working on them.
Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What's on your mind?
I want to piggyback on that last question. I'm a graduate student, and I'm trying to teach a community college eventually, and I'm wondering about, basically, I'm going to teach history, and I'm just wondering about further options as far as extra income for me.
Yeah,
and I'll take my answer off the air.
I want to take, that's fine. I want to say two things, in terms of extra income and in terms of one of the, you know, it is extraordinarily competitive to get hired as a faculty member at a community college or elsewhere. I really believe that the teachers who have the best chance of getting hired at community college are off-the-charts great teachers. They are amazing storytellers. I am listening, as those of you who are regular listeners to the show know, I listen to courses on CD from the company called The Teaching Company. I've taken a course for example, Great Minds in the Western Intellectual Traditions. I've taken courses on wisdom of history. And one of their instructors is a guy named Dr. Rufus Fears. He's a Harvard PhD who is a professor, many-time award-winning professor for teaching excellence. He is a storyteller. He always says, let us take you back to the day, August 13th, 1775, and you are a small silversmith in the town of Lexington, Massachusetts, or New Hampshire. And he then tells the story in rich detail. Become a great storyteller, and then get a guest lectureship at a community college where you're not getting paid, but you go in and you do a guest lecture where you tell an amazing story, perhaps coming in costume. And have it videotaped. Hire some kid from the local community college or from the local art school. There's a million of those who are unemployed, desperate to do some filmmaking, and pay them $50 or $100 to come and video the 30-minute mini lecture of you telling that amazing story in costume. Then send that to every one of the community colleges you'd like to teach. In my mind, that is the most potent way. Not a resume, not a bio, not nothing. Show, don't tell. I like to say that, like at Costco, when they try to get you to buy 10 pounds of meatballs, they don't say, here is the great meatball. They give you a sample. If you want to get hired as a history teacher, go give them a sample. With regard to getting hired as with regard to making some extra income while you're a graduate student, I really do think that this is just redundant. But if you are getting a PhD in history, there are many undergraduates who are majoring in history who have to write a senior thesis or a senior project. You are one step ahead of those senior students, which makes you actually better qualified than many professors to be a good coach or tutor in helping those students complete their theses. Sure, those undergraduates can go, their undergraduate senior project. Sure, they can go to their professors, but very often they're embarrassed to go to their professors because they don't want to reveal how little they know, etc. They'd rather hire somebody privately. So I would go to the professor of the seminars at an undergraduate institution there's usually a senior thesis seminar. Go to that professor. Say that you would like to be a coach to students who are working on their thesis. And of course, I expect absolute ethics. You're not writing their thesis for them. You are shepherding them. You are guiding them. You are providing whatever is appropriate ethical guidance. And because this is very high stakes for those college seniors, they want to get through, they would likely well pay you a reasonable way, $20-$25 an hour, which is not rich, won't get rich, but it's a reasonable side income. Not only will that help them, not only will it get you money, but that is yet one more thing that you can put on your resume and mention in your interviews to say, hey, you should hire me to be a teacher at your community college, because not only am I a great teacher as per watch this video, but I have my sideline occupation has been helping undergraduates complete their thesis. Can you see how that would give you a cut above, make you a cut above the millions of other applicants with social science degrees, including PhDs, who are trying to land one of those precious few jobs that don't just pay $2,000 or $3,000 a year per course, which unfortunately is what universities most often pay, despite their calling for fair wages for people. That's what they say in their classes. But when it comes to hiring, they will hire people for as little as they can get away with, part-time temp, so they can avoid paying benefits. I'll give out the phone number again. If you would like a 3-minute career makeover, whether you're unemployed, self-employed, employed by others, you simply have a career problem. That's the common denominator. I usually can at least give you a baby step forward, maybe even a giant step. All you need to do is call. The price is zero. What I charge fairly big bucks for during the week, you get for free here on KALW. The phone number here for what I call a three-minute career makeover or workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Some tips while the calls are coming in, but it just takes a moment to get them up on the line. I guess they're there already, so I won't even do that. Let's go. Oh my God, yeah, all the lines going. So let's go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air.
Hello again. I just called. I was a guy with dyslexia.
Oh, okay. How can I help?
Yes, I am really confused with my life. I'm pretty young. I'm 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do a paramedic program. But I love engineering, but I want to work on I want to be a merchant marine at the same time, work in the engines. So that's my goals. What do you think?
My question is, when somebody, you said you had pretty severe dyslexia, is these jobs that you're describing, whether it be repairing engines on a merchant marine
engines.
Ship, right, I understand, or a paramedic where you're dealing with life and death, you know, there is no tolerance for error. These are one of those fields. You know, if you're in a social science field, you're not going to kill anybody if you make a mistake. But if you are a paramedic or you are repairing an engine and you make one mistake, it can cause people's lives. Is your dyslexia one that you'd be wiser, if you care about really the ethics of it, would you be wise to avoid those fields?
No, it's just reading, not anything else. That's it.
Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about what I know about the paramedic field. It's one of those fields that's very easy to get into the field, and you get in as an emergency medical technician, an EMT, where it only requires, I think, only about 140 or 150 hours to get that initial certification, but the pay is terrible. It normally takes a good number of years to move up to paramedic. It's a very, very rewarding career. You are clearly involved in life or death. It's not a career that most people stay in for life because it is so adrenalized. It is psychologically wearing because you are seeing life and death. If there was a God, would you believe God says you have the gift of being able to stay calm and not burn out in spite of seeing, you know, torn up bodies and heart attacks and like? Do you have that gift?
Yeah, I do have that gift. I was raised in a pretty rough neighborhood, and yeah.
That's a great thing. Rough. It is certainly recession-proof. It is offshore-proof. And I would encourage you, it is like, unfortunately, I don't know if it's unfortunate, I'll take that judgment place out of it, it is becoming a nationalized industry. There's a major company called American Medical Response in that industry that is taking over. They're buying out or politically pushing out all the small providers. For example, there was a wonderful provider in Napa called Piner Ambulance, who provided outstanding service to the community forever. But then the politicians of American Medical Response wended their way in, and Piner's contract did not get renewed despite absolute support from the community. So the world is changing, just like Home Depot has replaced all the individual mom-and-pop hardware stores, or most of them. You probably will need to maximize your chance of a career, start with one of those major chains like American Medical Response. And talk to them about how to create a career pipeline so that you are not going to make crap wages for the rest of your life. Does that make sense?
Yes.
The other thing I want to suggest is there are two very different skill sets that are required for being a paramedic versus being a marine engine repairer. Some people are really wonderful and gifted in the visual spatial area, that is the kind of things that are necessary to be an engine mechanic. Others are terrible. Would you say that you have greater natural gifts in the area of, say, for example, being a paramedic, that is calming somebody down, being a really good diagnostician of a person and what's going on medically, or would you be better off at diagnosing and fixing that which is wrong with an engine?
Well, the thing is, I'm good at both things right now. I'm pretty young. I'm not really sure which things I'm pretty bad at it right now. So I don't know. But I think I feel that I'm more familiar with the crazy situations more than diagnosed mechanical problems.
Well, all things being equal, if you have equal aptitude in both, I would encourage you to go the marine fix-it route, the engine repair route, and here's why. It's more under the radar. There are many more people who are interested in being EMTs and paramedics. There are far fewer who are interested in becoming marine engine mechanics. And in an era of ever tighter budget problems, people are not going to replace their engines. They're going to repair their engines, whether it be civilian or military or corporate. So if all things being equal, given you saying you have mutual strengths in both areas, I would encourage you to go the engine route. And in fact, to tie things back to the previous guest, maybe in fact doing that within the military, where you can get your training on the military's dime, and they provide excellent, excellent training in that area. So if I, given this limited conversation, the limited time we've had, that's where I'd put my money. Does that make sense?
The military side does not make sense. I talked to a mechanic from the Navy that says, do not join the military to get trained. So that's the route I'm going.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much then for calling Work with Marty Nemco. That is all the time we have for this week. Thanks for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on callers. And my wife, Barbara Nemco, and I are going to discuss the classic book, Updated, How to Win Friends and Influence People in a Digital Age. Plus, you can call in, as I said, for 3-minute career makeover on Work with Marty Nemco. Until next Sunday, this is Marty reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.